At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 348 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Aaron A. Stay tuned to the end of the show, and we'll share what a co-producer is and how you can find out more about that.
Did we talk a lot about Sam's whiskey ever?
Oh, with the two of us?
Yeah, on the show. Did we ever discuss it on the show?
Clearly,
you and I have had discussions about the whiskey from Sam. I just didn't know if we'd done it on the show at all.
Not a lot, though, because you and I were waiting. I mean, other than the fact that he had it, you and I were going to do a tasting, and I don't think we ever did.
The point of my question is that I believe this week, Katrina released her gin, and I am way more excited about her gin than I am about whiskey. So, I mean, if I needed to be on somebody's, like, list to get stuff, this is the one. This is the one.
I'm very excited for it. Okay, I'm excited for it. And did you see the little you know, 20 whatever second commercial that with Eddie on the blanket with her, and then Eddie walks off? I loved it. It was so beautiful. I was like, oh my gosh, what's that? Right? And then I learned it was gin. And
it's
gin
called?
Is like the one. Like there's all kinds of alcohol that's, or different types of alcohol that, you know, that may not taste good to you, or that be, you know, whether you like, I'm not a huge.
Oh my God, is gin your whiskey?
Yes,
gin is your whiskey. Whiskey's my gin, Ginger.
We're twins, Summer. You probably put it the best way there is to explain it. What I was gonna say, and I'll shorten it, is that I guess just like foods, right? There's all kinds of foods. There's some things that you love, some things that I love. They may even like Venn diagram over each other. But there are definitely things that in our little circles that do not come in the Venn diagram, that do not overlap. So in the thing about, although I guess you could say with food too, the thing about alcohol is that unless it's, for me, gin, unless it's something really just foul, I can almost, I may not love to drink it, but you know, the thing about alcohol is you can mix so much and put like some sweetener or put like some drambuie, or, I mean, there, you can do so much. Like, I don't love tequila, but I love a good, like, low sugar margarita with lime, and you know, I love Skinny Girl margarita. I know that's probably not what you guys want to hear, but I do love a Skinny Girl. I like a lot of the Skinny Girl drinks. But my point is, I may not like a certain thing, but in the proper
drink,
yeah, or
mixture.
In the or with maybe a very specific or clever mix, or with like even a mixer, right? Like something like you put something sweet into something. Like I have not tried everything, but there's almost not an alcohol type that I despise. I just may not, you know, it's like, oh, I haven't found the thing that works for me. Girl, I have tried. And I even tried last year on my birthday. We went out to a birthday dinner. I think you were gone somewhere, but it was our parents and me. So we went out for my birthday last summer. And we went to Seasons 52, which is a restaurant that we have all been there together. I got whatever. I love getting their little cracker pizza. What do you call it? Not falafel. What do you call it? It's like a little,
like a flatbread.
Yes, the flatbread. It's so dependable, and it's so, oh my gosh, it's amazing. Anyway, so I always get their flatbread. So I can like a lot of things. Even if it's not my favorite, I might like it or be able to tolerate it in another drink. Now, gin is something that I have tried. So when we went out to my, I've tried it numerous times. We went out to celebrate my birthday last year to Seasons 52, a local restaurant, maybe a chain, I don't know, but one here in Sacramento area. And my dad was buying dinner, or my parents were buying dinner. It was a birthday dinner. That's great. I got a drink. I got a flatbread, and I got, I don't know, I don't think we got a dessert, but whatever. We ordered it, and I was looking at, you know, it's a seasonal menu, so it's not, it's frequently different. So we were looking at it, and I thought, you know what? I'm not driving. I may as well get a drink. Because I honestly, as much as I talk about loving whiskey, I really don't drink that often and that much. My tolerance is super low. I'm a very cheap date. So yeah. So I looked at their menu, on their drink menu, and it said, you know, it just, the way it was, what was it? It was some kind of, oh, it was like a hibiscus, rose hibiscus gin. I was like, oh, that sounds beautiful. It sounded amazing. I thought maybe with like a little bit of like, you know, like a some sweet, not sweetener, but like the little bit of like cordial, not cordial, but like the liqueur or something. I don't know. Something in it, like the rose or something sweet to kind of take that bitterness off, or the whatever it is off. I'm like, you know what? Maybe this is finally a gin drink I can tolerate. Why not? When is a better time to try? He's like, you know, I'm not driving. It's on my birthday. I'm not paying. This is great. So I order it, and I got it, and it was one of the most gorgeous drinks that I've ever seen. And I was so excited to try it. And I was like, please, Lord, let this be not disgusting. I didn't even care if I loved it. I just didn't want it to be disgusting. And I tried it, and I puckered, and I made a face, and our dad laughed at me. It was just like, I literally told him, I said, I feel so bad knowing that I usually don't like gin. Or I should just say I've never liked it in anything I've tried, which is pretty good track record. It was like a $14 drink. Not that that's super expensive, like it wasn't $30, but for that place, and I knew that it was, they don't have cheap stuff there, or cheap-ish stuff. So once I tried it, and I was like, I can't. It's disgusting. No amount of whatever they put in it. It was so beautiful. I was so disappointed that I didn't like it. And so I think he tried it. He tried it, and it was fine, but he was driving, so, you know, he couldn't have too much of it. But I told him, I said, I feel so bad. I'll let you pay for my meal, but I insist on transferring you the cost of this drink. He was like, Ginger, no, it's your birthday. I'm like, I know that, but I made a very stupid decision. Not a stupid, very bad decision. I knew there was a chance that this money could be wasted, like a decent chance. But I was so hopeful because of the description of what was in it that it's a hard no. So yes, apparently gin is my whiskey. That having been said, if we are ever invited to try gin or sent gin, like who gave us all that whiskey a few years ago? Dewars. So if we were ever contacted by a gin company, I would taste the ish out of it, and I would give my honest review, like Summer gives her honest review of the whiskey. I have a feeling that I might hate gin more than you hate whiskey. And the reason I say that is I think, not that it, not that I disagree, but I think the thing, because I had the same feeling about whiskey, the thing that kills you about whiskey is probably the taste, but the fact that it just like burns your entrails out every time, no matter how good the whiskey is, it always burns you. And I think you hate that especially. Gin doesn't burn me. It just, it's foul. I can't. So all that to say.
So I was only really bringing this up because to speak about the fact that the name.
Oh, Summer Gin.
Of her gin.
Summer Gin?
It is Forget Me Not.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's, and then, okay, so I saw that. What do you think I thought? I thought, I need that gin. I had the exact same thing as I did on my birthday last year. Right? Like the hibiscus, the rose. I got to try it. And I hated it. Forget Me Not Gin. You know there's not flowers in that gin. Come on. It's named after, it's for Outlander's sake. Fine.
Well, there's ginger. There are no Sassenachs in that whiskey.
Oh, stop it. I know that. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about gin and me being attracted to gin. That's my point. Even though I hate it, apparently.
She was clearly, look, she knows that she is best known for Outlander.
So she's smart.
She is using that thing about herself to sell this, because Sam stole Sassenach.
That is true. Sam.
Which, frankly, actually, he should have come up with something else. He should have come up with a masculine term for his
whiskey. She actually deserved to use Sassenach. I will say that. It should have been
his. Should have been Numpty.
Numpty. Oh, him.
Numpty whiskey.
Like that would have sold. Uh-huh. Well, it doesn't matter. It was Sam's. It was going to sell. Okay, so.
Oh, sorry. That's Richard Rankin. What does he drink?
Oh, gosh.
Does he drink whiskey? His would be Numpty.
I don't know. So, okay. So, I don't know. To the best of my knowledge, our itineraries for the trips that we're taking, well, I think it's one big trip for us, but the trips that we or our Pod Abroad, I can't even say franchise. That word scares me because we're not a business in that sense. But our branded tour, I guess you could call it, our Pod Abroad trips, the trips that have been rescheduled due to COVID for next fall of 2021. The large trip is still open, by the way, if you're interested. Can't believe we haven't mentioned that ever, like since the last 4 months. I don't think it's part of any of the itineraries. Definitely not. We might be able to mess around with the Pod Abroad proper, the big tour itinerary, because we usually have like a tiny bit of space that something might be able to be popped in. Honestly, even though I love that the whiskey distillery we've been to twice, I would like to go to a new whiskey distillery. But I think it would be nice to change it up and maybe do a gin tasting or a gin distillery tour. Because that's also, I mean, gin's all over, but you know, whiskey's all over tour. All over tour, all over two. So anyway, if we get a chance and you happen to be listening and you either own a distillery, because you never know, or you know someone who owns a distillery, we will be in Scotland, knock on wood. Hopefully there's a vaccine.
Or if you personally know Katrina Balfe and want to contact her to see if I could get a bottle of the Forget-Me-Not gin when it comes out, I'd allow that too. Just put it out there.
Well,
in the
yeah.
Universe, right?
As a matter of fact, we should look to do a tour, if they allow it, tour of the distillery that makes that. Anyway, just putting that out there. So, yeah. Okie dokie. I think that's a long announcement. That really... So the announcement is she has a whiskey. Yes.
Right?
I'm sorry.
I'm
sorry.
She has a whiskey. She has a gin. And I'm excited about it.
And you are welcome to it all.
I shall.
In this episode, we will be sharing the interviews I was a part of at this year's Comic-Con at Home. First up is Alyssa Samsel and Kate Anderson. They are the songwriters and composers for Central Park, and they together have worked on Olaf's Frozen Adventure, so you may have heard of some of their work. They were panelists for the Music for Animation panel.
I'm Ginger Wiseman. I am the producer and co-host of the Outlander podcast.
Allow.
Start out with something I typically ask composers and lyricists. What is your education, training, background? Where did you get to, or what made you want to, and how were you prepared for this work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I grew up doing musical theater my whole life, and then I went to Gettysburg College and studied music there, and I have a major, a BA in music with a creative writing minor. After I graduated college, my older sister, who is also a songwriter, kept encouraging me to do something called the BMI, Lehman Engel Musical Theater Workshop, and that is where I met Elisa. Do you want to give your background, Elisa?
Yeah. So prior to meeting Kate in that workshop that she just mentioned, I started violin and piano when I was 6. I was classically trained. That led me to a love of music in general. I found musical theater. I wanted to start writing for that, as well as performing. So I went to a conservatory in New York City called AMDA, American Musical and Dramatic Academy. And it was through performing for musical theater that I wanted to branch out and break all the type casting molds that had already been set and embedded in musical theater in general. And so when I met Kate, it was a perfect combination of we could be two female songwriters, pair up, and just break the mold with what is considered type casting and the characters that you'll see in musical theater.
And I'll just add that I also developed a love of comedy and did a lot of improv and sketch with Upright Citizens Brigade. So writing for a comedy show was always a dream of mine and a dream of mine and Elisa's as well. So this weirdly ended up being the perfect intersection of like all of our dreams.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ginger.
Thank you.
My name is Desiree Gazzetta. I'm with the Nerd Element. I have two questions. One is to follow up on what you were just talking about. And the basic one is just to talk about your process for writing your different projects, you know, Olaf and Central Park. And then the other one to follow up what you just said, what's it like being female in this industry for you?
Well, we feel very fortunate to have had mentors that we looked up to and other female composers that had broken that glass ceiling and created a path for us to follow. I'll never forget being about 20 years old, and I noticed a musical theater song called Taylor the Latte Boy that had been written by Marcy Heisler and Zena Goldrich. And when I looked up at the top of the page to see who had written it, I was shocked because I had never seen two female names on a piece of sheet music, even with all the years of classical training and all the music that I'd learned from the age of six. So seeing that inspired me to then pair up with Kate and become more names on the top of sheet music so that other girls can see that and realize I can do this too.
Yeah. And just to follow up, I think being two women in this industry it's definitely had its challenges, but we feel so grateful that right now and over the last 10 years or so, there's just been a lot of room made for females and for women to come in and tell these stories and to write material that is really authentic to the female experience and put a more female driven voice on things. And to speak to your process question, our process is, yeah, pretty different for varies project to project. It's also varied a lot through the years as we've figured out how to work together. And then at the more work we have, we've kind of figured out how to do it very quickly. And generally, when we have an idea for a song, we'll start out by talking about the lyrical hook and the musical hook. And landing on that first lyrical hook first, just because we want to figure out what's going to drive the song in terms of what's going to get us the most real estate, getting us from point A to point C. So what phrase can we sort of use and create different meanings for throughout the song so that we can have an evolution of plot. And then we oftentimes write music first. So Elisa will generally, once we have our lyrical hook, go off and come up with a musical structure and hand it back to me. And there's often lyrics throughout it that are helpful in guiding the structure. And I'll take a swing at fleshing it out a little more. And then we collaborate until we feel like it is perfect. So we do a sort of back and forth and a long conversation over the phone or in person to try and get it all nailed down and ready to go out on demo.
Hi, I'm Casey Mendoza and I'm the pop culture reporter for Newsy. My question is rather timely, but also continuation on that answer. But with the pandemic, I was wondering if either of you have been able to continue, you know, collaborating and working on projects either remotely or virtually?
Yes, we've been very fortunate that a lot of our projects are still in development. So we're still in the writing phase. And even we've been working on season two of Central Park, and that's all been over Zoom or email. So we feel very fortunate that animation is offering us the ability to continue writing songs that are hopefully putting out some positive energy into the world in this dark time. And that's our main goal, is to do just that. So anything theater related is obviously on hold. We had a couple projects that were slated to go to New York and be off Broadway, but that's on hold. But for the meantime, we'll keep our focus on writing for Central Park season two and any other work that we can do over Zoom or the phone.
Yeah, it's not too big a difference for us. This is a lot of the work we already do. It's just that our meetings have moved from being in person to digital.
Hi, this is Gareth at Student Reviewed, and my question is, how long does it take you to compose the music for Central Park, and roughly what's the turnaround between episodes? Thank you.
We usually have about a two-week period where we're supposed to get the song in demo form, and then do as many rewrites as needed until it's approved by that end of the 2 weeks. So that's generally how it was for season one. And so you really have to work fast and rewrite fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our goal is usually to get a demo in as quickly as possible so that we can start getting the feedback. So our first demos are usually just us trying to like loosely get, not loosely, but get in something that may not be like perfect, knowing that they're going to have notes, but something that's really fun and what we feel excited by, so that the writers and showrunners can be excited too and start giving us more specific notes.
Yeah. And I'll also add that sometimes we're juggling a couple songs at once. Mm-hmm. It might be more than one. So it really does become sort of a juggling act. But it got a lot easier as the season went on because we worked really hard starting from episode one, especially in that song Own It, to establish a musical character for each character. So the music has its own character. And then so writing as the season went on, it just got clearer what everybody sounded like. And that helped write as fast as we needed to write.
Hello, everyone. My name is Swara. I'm with But Why Though podcast.com. I would like to ask the both of you, what was the experience like working on Olaf's Frozen Adventure? And how did you try to make the music in the vein of Frozen, but also make it its own distinct thing?
That's a good question. Working on Olaf's Frozen Adventure was obviously a dream come true to get to write for Disney Animation, you know, as our first really big job. And it was daunting, but yet we had this incredible playground to play on that had already been set out for us by Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez. We also had a little bit of their guidance as we started out in the earlier phases of writing the music. And that was really helpful to just make sure we were sort of nailing it and getting the tone right and being true to the characters. It was really, really a fun experience. That team gelled so well. Our directors, Kevin Dieters and Stevie Wormers, and our writer, Jack Schaefer, we just had such a lovely, lovely collaboration with them. So it felt so easy in a way. Yeah, Elisa.
Yeah, and because it was so focused on Olaf, I think we went into it with such an optimistic view of writing the music for such an optimistic character, and I'm grateful that we had that experience because Olaf already had his sort of vocal range where he sat in from the original Frozen. So writing within that was so much fun for us that when we finally met Josh Gad for the day that he came in and recorded, I'll never forget. He said, the first thing he said to us, he had never met us before. And he said, why is this song so high? And he gave us such a hard time about writing the vocal part in such a high register, but that's where he sang in the whole first movie. And that sort of humor between us and Josh led to the friendship that ended up growing out of that experience, which then again led us to Central Park. So thank God Olaf sang so high, because otherwise I don't know if we would have become such good friends with Josh.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Good morning / afternoon / evening. I write for Bubble Blabber. Basically, my question will actually follow up the previous one pretty nicely. So the tone of an adult-oriented show like Central Park is probably quite different from a kid's special like, you know, Olaf's Frozen Adventure. So I'm wondering if writing for adults versus children, what parts of your approach to making the music stay the same which ones are different, and is all in all, it kind of difficult to make a switch if you're writing for like a different age group?
Yeah, it's funny because Elisa and I think have always been drawn to a tone in our writing that is whimsical and childlike, but what tickles us the most is when something sounds that way, but is very adult. And I'd say like that is where we probably live our happiest musical theater writing lives. And to be able to work on a show like Central Park, where it is family friendly, but it walks that fine line and sort of lives on that edge of being, you know, humorous and in an adult way, while staying true to being a musical, and also on top of that, animation. So that has its own sort of cartoony whimsy in it as well. It really is our sweet spot. So it hasn't been a challenge to shift over from like Olaf to that, because our early work was very, very, very much in this exact kind of vein, and it's kind of exactly what we love to do.
Yeah, and especially on Central Park, we're so fortunate because Lauren Bouchard and Nora Smith and Josh Gad, as the three creators, have been able to just give us the best safety net ever, because their genius brains are so good at that sort of humor. So we've been in great hands with them, and they've always been, from the very beginning, Josh wanted he wanted Central Park to be a true musical, because he was coming from The Sound of Frozen and The Sound of Olaf's Frozen Adventure, which is true musical theater, and, you know, in that Disney sense. And Lauren Bouchard has all of his incredible Bob's Burgers music. So that was the background that he was coming from. So I think it ended up being the perfect blend, and just sort of serving their creative vision.
Yeah.
Kept us in line with that sort of humor and whimsy that serves both adults and children alike.
Yeah. Lauren is so smart at nailing that tone. And one thing we've learned about him is he will never punch down. And he is very, very, he writes in such a positive way. He never wants to go negative. So it's really been so great to have him keep us in line that way and say like, hey, you know what? I just don't, that kind of might, you never know, that could hurt someone or whatever. And we're like, oh my gosh, you're so right. And we'll go write it again. Or he'll throw out ideas. And he and Nora often pitch funny jokes that make it in. So we're really lucky.
All right. Thank you both.
Yes.
Yes. Hi.
Work partnerships can often go into personal life. Has anything surprised you about your long-term relationship? Have any habits changed or it affect your work any?
That's such a fun question. We love talking about our working relationship because it's the highlight of both of our lives. We're so close. We're best friends. We've been best friends for 10 years. So to also be business partners and get to work with your best friend is a joy that I wish everyone had, could have. So I would say that we've only become better at working faster with mm-hmm. each other. The more work that we've gotten, we've come up with a very short shorthand between the two of us. And it enables us to juggle a lot of projects at once. So mm-hmm. we're very lucky that we have, at this point, begun to share a brain.
Yeah, we have a philosophy we live by too, which is to always treat whoever you work with like they're a genius. And we certainly have that respect and think that of each other. And it has helped our collaboration come super, super far because we just have such an inherent trust in one another. So our egos aren't ever trying to battle each other because we're really just trusting that the other person's instinct, if they feel strongly about something, is correct. And it's worked out very well for us.
I've interviewed a number of composers and lyricists before. It seems that that's kind of who I am able to interview each year at Comic-Con. So this is very fitting. And so I have some questions that I like to ask a lot of them. And one of them that I seem to come back to again and again, and I always get the most interesting responses, is when you're sitting down, so not maybe further on in the development, but at the very beginning of either a new project or a new song or a new composition, what comes first? And there are two of you, so it might be different, but what comes first, instrumentation or melody? So outside of lyrics, mm-hmm. when it comes to the music, what comes first? The instrumentation, you know exactly what, do you hear, when you hear a sound, do you hear the instruments playing, or do you hear just a plain melody you have to get out first and then add instrumentation?
That's a great question. I'd say that, Kate was right when she said that we always like to come up with the lyrical hook first. So for instance, when we were coming up with Own It for Central Park, we came up with that, but that two word hook, and it didn't have a melody. So what we'll do is decide upon the melody. And this is most of the time, because there are other times where Kate will sing a melody and then I'll go and I'll set it and then base the rest of the song around it. But most of the time, for me, when I'm coming up with the music at the piano, the melody and the accompaniment are linked because they both lead each other, which is a great metaphor for how Kate and I work music and lyrics too, because there couldn't be one without the other. Mm-hmm. And that's that same idea of there couldn't be one without the other is how I come up with the melodies and the music underneath it. They're really linked for me. And I've never really thought, that's a wonderful question, and I'm so glad that you asked it, because I've never really thought about that before. But what's happening underneath the melody to me has to be the emotional subtext to the melody itself. And I think the melody is the emotional subtext to the lyric itself. So mm-hmm. it becomes a three-tiered it's almost three tiers in my brain when I'm doing the music, if that makes sense.
Great, cool. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Ginger.
I go by Tommy, but that's not important. I'm the movie and award specialist for Culture Slate. Mm-hmm. We're fairly new up and coming. I guess my big question is, so I'm sure you know, music can be just as important for a character as dialogue or situations. I mean, without John Williams' score, the shark from Jaws is just a camera going through the water. So I guess my big question is, when you see or read about a character, what's your process for determining the, I think leitmotif is the correct phrase for that character that, you know, adds so much to the character, as much or even more than something like dialogue or relationships? So, makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely does. I think with these Central Park characters, knowing who our cast was right off the bat was really, really helpful. And then, of course, reading the script and learning about each character's personality. If you look at the song Own It, that's sort of where the first song where we set everybody's musical language for their character. And that came out of loving the actors' personalities and talents, but also knowing what their want is in that first episode and wanting to set it up for not only the first episode, but also the entire season. So we knew, for example, that Owen, played by Leslie Odom Jr., would need to be sort of this dorky dad, and that his music should reflect that, and that he should be a little let down, but also hopeful that maybe some other people will learn to love the park as much as he does. And, you know, with Catherine Hahn's character, Paige, we wanted her to sound driven, but also like quirky and very like, wah! Like very, a little bit of a mess as well. But smart and clever. We wanted Molly and Cole to be both longing and romantic. They both have this love in their heart that needs to come out, with Cole's for the dog, with Molly, she's getting to be boy crazy. And then you've got Helen, played by David Diggs, which we knew had to be pattery and sort of a rap, but and a little bit secretive and conniving. And then, you know, Bitsy has her little speech. And Bitsy is, you know, Bitsy spans she's a classic villain, but also just has her own thing going on. And Stanley Tucci is just so funny at at everything. Like he just spins everything into comedic gold. I'll let Elisa speak to it too and her process, but that's basically where we were coming from in figuring those characters out.
Yeah, between, Kate said it beautifully, between knowing who the cast was and the very quirky, unique personalities that each character had in the script while we were reading, between those two aspects, it almost wrote itself. And it was such a joy to be able to give each character their own sound and then, like in a true musical, carry that through till the end of the series so that the whole series is like a giant musical, but each episode is also a mini musical. So it couldn't have been more of a pleasure to write for those characters and be able to sort of carry that through a whole season of TV.
It's all about giving them a musical vocabulary and a lyrical vocabulary that speaks to the characters' ambitions and intelligence and, you know, what drives them. So it's fun. Hello.
Hey, thanks, ladies, for taking the time. My name's Jimmy. I'm from the Saturday Morning Serial podcast. And you kind of just answered my question. I wanted to know if you write more for the characters or if you might write more for the voice actors when you're writing your music. So in case I don't get a chance to circle back around to another question, I'm going to ask something that's a little more on brand for our podcast, if you don't mind.
Sure.
We like to talk about it, getting up early on Saturday mornings and having to fight your brothers or sisters for a spot on the couch to watch your favorite cartoons in the morning on Saturday mornings. Mm-hmm. So what we had to do is you got to get up extra early so you can pour yourself a big bowl of cereal to get your spot on the couch. So I want to know, ladies, what is your favorite Saturday morning cereal?
Oh my gosh, Golden Grahams.
Nice.
Actual cereal?
Yeah.
The breakfast food?
yes. You put milk in it. Usually eat it with a spoon.
Honeycombs. It doesn't even need milk.
Nice. Right out of the box. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
So my other question was, is there a big difference in process between composing for a show like Central Park versus composing for Disney? The most powerful media company that ever was. So as you mentioned, the 2-week process you have to get out between each episode. So is there a big difference between Central Park and writing for Disney?
Yeah, there was. And both have been the most incredible writing experiences of our careers. Mm-hmm. And I would say the major difference is when we were writing for Disney is such a well-oiled machine at this point when it comes to musicals. They have their format, they have their incredible music department, and they know exactly how to conveyor belt out, if that could be a verb, to conveyor belt out.
Yeah.
A stunning project that everybody would say, oh, this belongs in the Disney family. And then with Central Park, no one had ever done this before. And I remember when Josh first came to us and asked us about it, he said, I want to create TV's first true musical. I want to do something that no one's ever done before. And the fact that Apple TV got on board and Lauren Bouchard was there to share all of his knowledge from creating 10 seasons of Bob's and incredible music on that show. Mm-hmm. The fact that we got to have all those players involved and then basically step into the Wild West, the Wild Wild West, no one knew what it was going to be. No one knew what the process was going to be. Mm-hmm. And then the incredible music department that we came up with there for Bento Box doing Central Park became its own conveyor belt. Yeah. And it hadn't been built before. So being part of that process, building a new format, it was a challenge, but so rewarding, because now that we've got season two under our belt, we couldn't be more excited to keep going and to keep moving forward with everything that we learned and everything that we developed working on season one.
Yeah. I think the big difference is like doing 10 times the amount of songs at 10 times the speed and with 10% of the, resources and experience and figure out and also building the music team as we were going through season one. Frank Chompy from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend came on about halfway through the season and he's our music supervisor. So even just figuring out like those roles and trying to think ahead before something became like a necessity, like, you know, even just sheet music or whatever for the actors to record. It was all just kind of like, like Lisa said, the Wild West, but we figured it out and it worked and, you know, and we got, there's not an 80 piece orchestra, but there are songs that sound like there's an 80 piece orchestra and yeah, we're just really lucky because everybody really rallied together to make that happen.
Yeah, we got to feel like pioneers creating a musical for TV animation.
I'm a little curious about the development process of the show as a whole, as well as your place in it as the songwriters. So was the script basically like pretty much set in stone by the time that you began developing music, or did the writers of the show itself like a rough idea and then the whole show kind of came together like along parallel axis, if that makes sense? So like, mm-hmm. would there ever be like a moment where a song would evolve in a particular way that it would alter the script? Like, was it like really organic, or did it really like one thing come after the other?
Again, all part of the figuring out, sort of getting our footing as season one began. We actually came onto the project in 2017, when all that existed was about 10 pages of a script, by Lauren and Nora, and the idea itself. So we wrote that first song, Central in My Heart. That was part of the pitch packet that they put together. It was a rough animatic that they took out to see who wanted to make it. From there, actually getting into the writing of season one, it's sort of varied a little bit episode to episode. And now I'd say like we're in the well-oiled machine area where the writers are cracking story, and getting the script into a certain place before we are seeing the moments of song. And then the way that we weigh in and other writers as well is just trying to figure out the best way to use musical, get the musical bang for our buck, and figuring out where like the best real estate that the song can take up. If it's a song that just needs to be a fun, joyous moment of singing, or if it's a song that needs to accomplish a lot of plot. And if that's the case, then we might be asking for a little bit more time, or even saying like, hey, this whole dialogue section right above the song, like we can put that in the song and make it all flow. So that's sort of the back and forth now.
Yeah, and I just want to add quickly that I'm so glad that we got involved 3 years ago when they were just coming up with 10 pages and the basic idea, and, you know, then maybe we'll make a pilot. I'm so glad we got in at that stage, and we have to thank Josh Gad for that, because one thing that continues to make me so happy that we did get to influence in terms of the music of the entire series was that when they came up with the original concept, all they knew is that they wanted Birdie, Josh's character, to be a busker in Central Park. Mm-hmm. And I asked if he could play violin because I used to be a busker in Central Park with my violin. And they said yes. And we had the idea of him strumming it like a guitar, which happens a lot in the season. There are these little ditties in a lot of the episodes where he's strumming it as you would a ukulele or a guitar. And that really helped shape the show itself, because then they knew, okay, well, we can get this information with Birdie playing, you know, strumming his violin and sort of very like the narrator he is, very pitter-pattery getting information across in a little song. So I'm glad that we got to establish that from the get-go, because it really shaped the way that we would portray information through Birdie's character as the narrator who plays violin in Central Park.
Hi, I'm Kai from Keep Hearing. We've also been through a lot of our questions, but we do have a fan question. As musicians, have you guys ever been watching something and you realize that there's an absolutely just spectacular song and a really terrible movie?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, yeah, I'm having a hard time thinking of an example. But I'm sure that's the case.
Sorry to make you name names.
I know it's tricky, because then we would have to say what movie we think is terrible.
Yeah, but certainly those, like, there's like some 80s movies or like things that came out, around the time I was growing up.
Right. One that stands out to me, I wouldn't say that the movie is terrible, but I remember watching this movie and not expecting to be overwhelmed by the song that happens. And it was in The Last Unicorn. Mm-hmm. I that song makes me giggle so much, mm-hmm. you know, when The Last Unicorn flies.
The last piece of the past.
Yeah. Over the, yeah. I wouldn't call the movie terrible, but that particular surprise of the song in the movie made me very happy.
Mm-hmm. Hello again, Jimmy from Saturday Morning Serial. We talked a lot about the positive ways that you influenced the show and a lot of things like that. But have you ever gotten all the way finished with a project and turned it in, or halfway or almost done, and had to scrap it, like they weren't happy with what you were doing and had to start all over from the beginning and retool everything?
Yeah, we've certainly seen a bunch of stuff hit the cutting room floor, so to speak. On Central Park, we've lost a few songs and started over completely. And I will say that every time we did start over, begrudgingly, it always ended up being a better song. So, yeah, it's not, I mean, it certainly sucks when that happens, but it usually ends up being worth it. And I think on Olaf that happened a few times as well. And certainly in the musicals we've written, we could do entire concerts with the cut songs. Mm-hmm. And someday we might.
I was going to follow up. Do you ever retool them and use them again in other places, like for another character, or do they work?
Oh, that's I mean, I will say, yeah, maybe.
The thing is, we've heard of that being done, and I will admit that we have tried it, but it never works, because I think each time we write a song, it really is destined for that character in that moment and what that the current emotion is, mm-hmm. that they're feeling. You know, they say that you burst into song when words can no longer suffice. And that makes them pretty unique and almost like fingerprints, in the sense that they're not one size fits all. I almost wish they were. It would make our lives so much easier. We wouldn't have to write so many songs. Yeah. But it is hard to take one emotion and pretend that it also works for another person's emotion.
Yeah, we've definitely attempted it. And
yeah, not successfully.
Hi, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I'm Natalie with the Daily Fandom. Earlier, you guys kind of talked about you liked whimsical music, especially when they go into more adult themes that don't seem to match it. Mm-hmm. Got me thinking, have you ever been watching anything and you wish it, you could have written the music for it? Like, it's not a musical, but you're like, I could turn this into a great musical.
Oh, you mean have we ever been watching something and thought it would make an incredible musical?
Yeah. Okay. Like a show, movie.
Certainly. I mean, I would love to be the one to get to write Bridesmaids, the musical. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. And I thought you were asking, are there things that we wish we had written, like writer jealousy? And also yes to that. Big time.
Yeah, we often see movies or read books that we really wish we could make into a musical. And Dumplin' was another one that just came out because we loved the message about body image, mm-hmm. that it was just, it did so well. And that's a, mm-hmm. that's a topic that we would love to bring to a musical at some point and talk about body positivity, and especially coming from the female voice. I think that's a very underrepresented view, that the art world could, you know, the artistic medium could really benefit from, is hearing more stories like the one they tell in Dumplin'.
I would definitely see both of those musicals, Dumplin' and
I think Dolly Parton is going to want that one.
Yeah, she should have it.
So I know you mentioned earlier you got inspired by the song Taylor the Latte Boy, which my high school women's choir did that song, so that was kind of a blast from the past to hear you mention that one. But I was wondering, like, what other sort of composers, songwriters have inspired you? And it can be anything, John Williams, Beethoven, AC/DC, whatever, that have really helped inspire you, maybe shape your craft a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, you know, I think our biggest influence would probably be Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez. That's definitely up there. Marcy and Zena, who Elisa mentioned before, who wrote Taylor the Latte Boy. I used to work at a day job, and I, in order to like become a better lyricist, I just would put on Sondheim radio on Pandora at the time and just try to educate myself with all of the Sondheim I possibly could. And sometimes that leads to mimicry. I've seen a lot of songwriters mimic him. And so we try really hard not to do that. But he's such a master at lyrical craft. And so, you know, to take those lessons away and apply them in your own way is definitely, I would recommend any lyricist do that. And then, yeah, musically, oh my gosh, it's just so many. This is not musical, but my influences and my heroes are Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and, mm-hmm. Smart comedic women like that who have created such a wonderful, safe world for females to be crass or, you know, just to break out of the mold of what we, are expected to be or have been expected to be in the past. Elisa?
Yeah, I share all of Kate's inspirations as well. That's why we get along so well. We have very similar tastes. I also have gotten a lot of my inspiration from film scores. As you said, Jaws would be nothing without the score. And I think for me, I'm so attracted to the way that the most incredible film composers can take a silent scene and turn it into the most heart-wrenching experience of your life just through their music. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I mean, Howard Shore and his score to all the Lord of the Rings movies really made an impression on me. And another film score composer who has not only inspired us, but also sort of changed our life is Michael Giacchino. We were always huge fans of him. And then through mutual friends at Disney, now we're friends with him and we've collaborated on some songs with him. We've got a Christmas song coming out this year with him. So it's really incredible when people that have been inspirations to you also then become collaborators. Yeah. It's wild, but we're very lucky in that regard.
I mean, I know that a good film score can almost be a character in and of itself.
Yes.
Hi, good afternoon. I would like to know which is your favorite place to work on a song and why, please.
Our favorite place to work on a song?
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Okay. That's a good question.
Together.
Together. Pre-corona, I'd say I love to go to a cafe and get a coffee and sit there and be the weird girl singing to herself for a couple hours, and time disappears when you're, you know, in the zone, which is really kind of cool. Yeah.
My favorite place to work on a song is if it can't be with Kate, then sort of well, obviously at home, I write everything at home, but I've got so many memories of when Kate and I would work in the same room, and getting her to laugh is my favorite joy in life. You feel like it's such a feat. So I know that this is a very metaphorical answer, but my favorite place to write sort of exists in memory, because I've had so many memories of writing in the room with Kate, and if it makes her laugh, then it stays in the song.
Nice. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Dan Shea with Saturday Morning Serial.
Hi, Dan.
I know it's the last question, but this is also the last question we always ask composers on our show. So essentially, it's a little bit of a hypothetical. I'm looking to get an elevator pitch from you guys.
Oh boy.
Say, hypothetically, I'm a producer, and hypothetically, you want this job. You've got me cornered in an elevator, and here are the elements of the show I want to do. It's a animated, like old Saturday morning cartoon style, half hour kids adventure show about a group of dogs that operate a mining town in the Old West, but on Mars.
You just gave the best one. How do we compete with that?
I just want to hear, like, what is the theme? What is the musical accompaniment you think ought to go with all those themes?
Okay. So I would say, like, picture an old prospector terrier named Sparky. He's an old miner. I don't know, this is so weird. He must recruit his other canine pals and convince them that there's gold in them, their Mars hills. And so with a score that reminds us of Elisa, who is that composer who did that? Dur, dur, dur. You know what I'm talking about. He just passed away.
Leone.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
With a score that reminds us of that, we see the trials and tribulations of this scrappy gang of canine pals who must band together to stop the railway thief gang of cats who are threatening to invade their Martian town. And in one last-ditch effort to save their mine and save the town, they have to put on a talent show and do a musical that reminds us of cats, but it's dogs.
And every lyric is bark.
Old choice. Yeah, we just hit the lobby, but just especially that little everything is a bark. I like that.
Everything's a bark. Yes.
All right. Well, I'll get back to you, but that was promising.
Okay.
That was
promising.
Here's our card.
I've never felt so put on the spot. My heart's pounding.
Call us.
Well, thank you guys very much. I do appreciate you playing along like that. And I wish I had a better question since it's the last one.
And our next interview was the panel with James Pierce Conley. He was production designer on The Masked Singer, The Voice, The Kelly Clarkson Show, and is also a pioneer in virtual production. And that actually was something I was not expecting in this interview, but due to the time of the pandemic and so much of the industry is being turned upside down, right? So certain things like actors and people who need to be on screen together, they're finding ways to make that safer. But a lot of stuff, whether it be set design or just so many other things that we really had no idea of, are being turned upside down as far as people are being made to think outside the box. And so this, I had a few questions for him. I knew from reading articles about interviews with John Gary Steele and different things that they had done and hearing all the producers talk about the sets on Outlander. So I am minimally educated on the process of set design. But this was, I thought, a fascinating interview. I had no idea it would take the turns it took. So I hope you really enjoy it.
I'd like to introduce you to James Pierce Conley.
Hi.
Hi, this is Desiree Gazzetta. I work for the Nerd Element. I wanted to ask you about The Masked Singer. What has been the most challenging production for you on that show, and what has been the most fun?
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a big question. I would say that the most challenging production was the actual production itself in season one. If you just imagine sort of my journey with the show was, I heard about the show. I was very excited. Ooh, a big Fox stage show that involves music. This is so cool. And when I learned about the show and it was told to me that, you know, it's a format that started in Asia and Thailand and Korea. You should check it out on YouTube. And this is a show where, celebrities are going to dress up in big, outrageous costumes, and you're going to guess who they are. And so there was a moment of, you know, what is my career? You know, what is this? And then there's a follow-up moment of like, you know, it's my job to sort of make this transferable to the audience and make it cool. And what are these costumes like? And so there was a lot of discussions on how do we make that for an American audience. And this is the most challenging and the most rewarding because looking at superheroes and how Spider-Man and Batman and all these Marvel characters can become super cool to audiences was an approach on how to take Masked Singer with these costumes and look at them as sort of superheroes. And what did their world look like? So for backstage, I studied the Batcave and Batman's lair, and where he hung up all those costumes in backstage was a very transferable point for design for me. And then the stage really was birthed out of Burning Man and Coachella and opera. And so you could get these, it sounds crazy, but like these sort of superheroes that were that their costumes were really like appreciated on like the sort of operatic stage. And so ultimately that has been the biggest challenge as I look back on the show. From here on out, it's just been fun, you know, designing clues and performances and understanding, you know, I actually don't know who the celebrities are. They keep all the secrecy down to like a very handful of people. But trying to guess and as well as embrace those characters and make background stories to those characters is probably just, it's just so much fun.
Perfect. Hi, this is Casey Mendoza. I'm the pop culture reporter for Newsy. This is a bit of a two-part question, but what are the most, especially now, the most common conversations you're having about health and safety with in-person productions and live stage work now? And what are the biggest things you're keeping in mind as a production designer, even though I'm sure everything is so unprecedented and different?
Oh my God, this is such a good question because I just want to let you know. I own a design studio. I design variety shows for a living. I probably do between 25 and 30 a year. We maintain series, and we also do, my favorite stuff is the new stuff. With the pandemic hit, we obviously hit a little bit of a slowdown, but then an incredible amount was sort of like standing in front of a fire hose, because suddenly what you don't realize is everyone needs good design right now. Everyone needs solutions. You don't have audiences anymore. And for thousands of years on a stage production, you've leaned into what an audience would transfer in energy to the performance. And suddenly, what do we do, James? What can we do? So exploring technology has been an immediate ask. But I will tell you, Casey, some of the things I'm hearing every single day. Now, I don't go through every COVID class like my fiance does, who's in production at Netflix. He hears all the COVID rules all the time. We talk about them over dinner sometimes. But what I hear as a designer is I need to redesign the desk for all the judges. Everybody needs to be 6 feet apart. We need to design solutions for audiences over and over and over again. But ultimately, what's netting out is we cannot reveal that we're in a pandemic. We don't want to see plexi barriers. This is not a negative approach. This is an upgrade to the world. This is a chance to redesign negative spaces that we need for physical distancing in a way where we can fill it with design and artful elements and things to enhance the story and mood. And so it's been an exciting time for a designer. You know, everybody needs solutions, and we're happy to give our partners and our clients as much as we can and explore. And we're learning all the time. I mean, sometimes it's been tough, but that's where I'm at. Yeah. Judges, desks, audiences, and negative space to fill has been nonstop. And really it's exciting. I will say the next batch of shows that comes out in fourth quarter, right? They're all starting to be produced a little bit now and then. Maybe in the new year, in the spring, you'll see really incredible art, because that's where you need to lean. What you need to lean into to fill and give that vibe to the viewer at home. So it's watch The Masked Singer next season. I mean, what we're doing with AR and virtual is unbelievable. Watch the award shows and the big variety shows, because they're the ones who are sort of the test pilots in production right now to get things out there and try COVID rules and see things. And the fun stuff that we're making is exciting. So it's cool.
Kai from the Geekery. My question kind of builds on what you were just talking about. A long time ago, relatively, there was the very long writer's strike, and we had a big surge in television that came out of that. You talked a little bit about how people are going to be adapting what we're doing now for COVID rules, but do you think that there's any kind of like new medium or new expression of media that's going to come out of us having to suddenly make a whole bunch of content without touching?
Oh yeah. I mean, this is by far and away bigger than any writer strike ever could imagine to influence. You have an entire industry, a huge global industry, all entertainment, not working, trying to figure out how to tell stories. And the demand for stories is huge. And everybody's looking to design writers and directors to figure out new ways to do that. So this is a major renaissance. I mean, I've had multiple conversations with VFX houses and animators, for instance, because they can tell stories without a lot of people on site to create a production. So they can create them in the computer, create them with their hands, and make those stories without a lot of COVID safety risks. I think there's a huge awakening to VFX industry and the pre-production industry looking at virtual production. I think what's happening now, I'm not sure it's a sudden run to it, but I think everybody's self-educating on what they can do to minimize footprints on stage. And the answer right now is virtual production. And if people can understand that and try to harness good quality out of that, I think, for instance, The Mandalorian is probably the most talked about show on the planet. And it's because even though they did the same thing on Solo, we're talking about The Mandalorian, the virtual backgrounds mixed with a physical element in front that can give the actor something to react to in a single camera narrative is everyone's learning about it. Everyone's trying to understand it. It's making the VFX industry upside down because it's something that happens now in pre-pro and during production as opposed to post. And I think that in the future, we'll never go back to the way it was done. I think we're finding new efficiencies. I think that we'll miss the way it used to be, and I think we'll go back immediately, but then we'll sort of bounce back and sort of see what we learn from this and combine it to some really exciting stuff. So I feel like virtual production is what to keep your eye on, and I think that everybody's looking at it.
Hi, thanks so much for being with us. I actually want to build off of that previous question. There's a couple of previous questions. We're talking about the VFX industry, the animation industry, but I'm more now interested about VFX. And as you were talking about The Mandalorian and so many of these large productions are using so much more special effects that it can almost replace the sense of being in somewhere real and somewhere felt. And, you know, we've had this discourse in film, Twitter, among critic circles for so many years now. So what can really be that appeal of the VFX realm when audiences still do want something quote unquote real or something that can be felt? And in particular, I am wondering about that sort of, how do you still introduce that human element, especially in the time of COVID? And are you going to get to the point where actors will like be recording themselves in separate places and then you try to splice it together? I mean, I know this is sort of an open-ended question, but like my mind is now open to possibilities, but I'm also like almost concerned about, you know, how storytelling is going to go. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I feel like you're asking the same questions everybody is. And, you know, like there are millions of people asking the same exact questions. And the truth of the matter is set right now is probably the safest place to be. They are taking so many precautions. I mean, you have people in gowns, face masks, face shields, pre-tested the 2 days before. There are literally guardrails up for 6-foot distancing on sets. I mean, it's more safe than the grocery store or walking your dog outside. I mean, it's beyond safe. And so I feel like minimal people is what COVID rules are demanding, and distance. I don't think they're asking for isolation. And so as we stay with this and learn about storytelling with minimal people and minimal footprint, it's a chance to look at other industries that do it well. And they're looking at the video game industry. They're looking at feature films and single camera narratives. They're looking at smaller footprints, live events, parking lots outside where those were events. And they're just trying to pull solutions from any direction and mix it, because it's really, like we said, unprecedented, and it's a time to explore any solution. So in terms of virtual production, what VFX industry is great at is photorealistic details and technicians, right? Like they can take production work. They can be present on productions on site, but they can take that content, and they can make it something with green screen markers and stuff like that. But suddenly there's a demand to have all those people now in the beginning of the production. And so you've got to ask the VFX industry to work with the people who create the initial story environments in the beginning, like the production designers, like myself, like the DPs. And now they're forced to play together, which is completely upending their process. And they're trying to figure out how that works. And so it's a lot of stumble, and there's a lot of education, and there's a lot of people talking to each other that's never talked to each other before, and it's really exciting. I feel like, just to address the last point that you made in terms of how do you get this to the audience? Well, if you can get it to the talent, if you can make that world believable to the actor or the contestant, then the audience is going to feel that. And so for decades, we've used green screen. But that's not very good for giving the actor something to work from. Like a green dummy with a stick, that kind of stinks. But an LED screen with a pre-rendered photoreal backdrop that moves is a place where the actor can feel alive, or the contestant. And so I feel like that's brand new technology. And that's what's being embraced now to use for storytelling. And we'll see. I mean, it makes people nervous. When you're going to go ahead and spend $10 million on something, you want to check all your boxes and cross all your T's first. So people are definitely just learning, self-educating, looking at the risk takers. But I'll say we'll see a lot more of it in the future.
Yes, hi. It's so great to meet you here, Indy, here. Thank you for the opportunity. So with all of this talk or news, everyone knows about COVID, coronavirus, and it impacts so many different industries. And you've just very eloquently talked about how it's impacted the industry, your specific niche in the industry, processes being turned upside down. How has your, if you have noticed it, and it sounds like you have, how has your personal process been changed? It sounds like there's a lot more collaboration happening now, because like you said, things that are happening maybe toward the later bit of a process are now being moved up, and different people who maybe didn't have to work together as much, if at all, are now being put into situations where they have to make these decisions closer to the top. So how is your personal process? Like when you take on a new assignment, a new job, and you start, whether it's researching a time period or looking at who the people that will be, the talent who will be there, the other people that you'll be working with, how has your personal process been affected? And as far as the effects on the industry, have you noticed what you yourself have been doing?
Oh God, yeah, Ginger, thanks. I mean, the variety world is the guinea pigs of production right now. And so we are in every direction exploring anything. Because we're risk takers, we don't have high-level celebrities all the time. We can do small shows and big shows, so we're out there for sure. We're working. It has forced me beyond my comfort zone in so many things, but I'll just hit on a couple. I, for the last 6 years, I've used Epic Games Unreal software to design. It's created a way for me to eliminate render times in my studio, for me to see immediate results, and to time crunch, right? I'm gonna change the light to red. I don't have to wait 20 minutes for it to render out. I can just see it right there. I have never told that to anybody. It's been a secret ingredient. I am now screen sharing with every director to show real-time rendering, to get him to see what I'm seeing immediately so that we can get decisions fast and get an agreement. So without delaying, emailing, going to a meeting in person. That's been awesome, but it's also been revealing something that is my workflow, you know? And so that's been great. And it's also opened me up to new technology because we're so fluent in Unreal. I would say though, there's an other side to this. You know, everybody's nervous, everybody's scared. Like I just said, before you spend $10 million, you got to understand. So part of my world is to also translate what I'm doing in the way we've always done it. So if we're going to make a virtual production, and I've been now part of three of them, we've got to talk about that, how we used to do it. If you're going to build some scenery walls, basically, Ginger, what I say, and basically what we've noticed, is it takes almost the exact amount of time to build a physical set as it does to rebuild a virtual set. I've got to hire probably a couple less carpenters, they're 3D modelers, to rebuild that. But I need the same amount of time because it's just probably the same amount of work. I mean, I'm going to model up each little bolt head, and one guy in a shop is going to hammer in those bolt heads. So you got to sort of understand how you're navigating that process to the client. Well, I'll just say client because it could be a director or a producer or whatnot. So it's relatable to what we just did before March. So it's a lot. And I would say those are my two big ones.
How, because of this change and because of your entree into the industry, how what advice would you give someone going forward now? Because there is, as you said, there's no going back. There might be elements of back, but no back. What advice would you give someone now as opposed to March who wants to get involved in this industry?
This is the best time to get involved in this industry. We had an intern about to start with us in May from the Television Academy. We host the Television Academy internship in my studio for the last 6 or 7 years. And this poor guy, Grayson from North Carolina, thank God he's a junior, so he'll have another year to apply. Went through the entire process of sending the portfolio, got chosen, and then this horrible pandemic hit. But to be honest with you, we had a mentorship session, a 1 hour, a couple of times. I told him, this feels like, to me, when I moved out to California at the time of 9/11, where things were just a little upside down, a real chance to not have to break into something so conventional, where people were looking for any solution possible to insert yourself in a space where you could become really needed. I said, look at this as an opportunity to help people rethink. You're engaged in software they don't know. This is a great time to enter the industry. My advice is to not follow any sort of conventional process that was, you know, handed down through the history of sonography. We're not to think about building an environment in any way you could, and rethinking how you can, and throwing out ideas is welcome in this world right now. And I think you're going to see a lot of change. I think you're going to see a lot of people moving out from different careers that they didn't necessarily love, relationships that they didn't necessarily were part of. There's going to be a lot of job openings this fall and winter. And I think that it's a great time to get started. And I think people just need to keep themselves open-minded.
Hi, this is Garrett at Student Reviewed. And I had a couple of questions. You were talking about the virtual sets and that sort of thing. And I'm curious about what emerging tech beyond that are you most interested in? And when a new technology like that comes out, is it essentially learn as you go, or there are classes that you take, or a mix of the two to become proficient at it? Thank you.
For sure. Gareth, you make me realize that I'm probably yelling, so thank you. I think that it's a new technology, and I'm mostly interested in added-on software to Unreal that can help add value to the current rendering process of Unreal. I work mostly in multi-camera television, and that adds another level of difficulty to making Unreal work on a wraparound background screen, an LED screen, and it adds a little bit more complication in some of the technical pipelines of linking servers to those cameras and how do they all talk to each other. Very interested in all that. There is no college class or MFA program in this, so I've been doing most of my education when I can by engaging with people in groups like on Facebook or Reddit, looking at a general YouTube just to refresh my memory, and just talking to some people who use the program in different ways than television is where I've been learning. And it's really just kind of staying active in conversations about it and sending out a problem like a flare in an empty ocean to anyone who will answer. Is where I'm kind of teaching myself, and I have to guide a team, and thankfully my team is smarter than me, so they've been teaching me too, and so they're boots on the ground in the software all the time when I'm taking more Zooms, but I am learning myself, and there's no prescribed method. If you want to learn, I have learned so much from Facebook and Reddit and a couple of YouTube videos, so practice.
Thank you, Gareth. Liana, please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much, James, for taking and doing this. Liana from Culture Slate. We've got two questions. The first is, you talked about showing other people your process. What have you learned from others that you've now incorporated into your workflow? And secondly, your positivity is just admirable, especially through all this. Some people would just like melt down, and some people have, but you found ways to become more creative, avenues to really expand. So how do you, what do you do to motivate yourself and keep that positivity?
Oh, cool. Sure. Well, I have learned so much from other people, particularly other industries. I said fiance. In my personal life, we've had to push our wedding a couple times out for COVID. But I'm learning so much about how to talk to people from talking to the wedding planner. She is wonderful in navigating a very personal process, basically about design, right, that I'm learning to transfer to my clients. And it's, I would say, probably the most from that, which is sort of exciting. In terms of positivity, listen, honey, we all have our moments, right? There are times where I am right on Redfin and like, I am moving out of here. I am over this. I am exhausted. But I, looking back on this process with going through the pandemic, I'm motivated by my team. There was a time where I was just like, I just have to get up and go and just sort of make sure that everybody feels like we're going to be okay. And so some of it's been faking it, to be honest with you, and just making sure that the team knows I've got it under control and I'm hitting the pavement hard and providing a sense of confidence to them. And be honest with you, when you do that and they feel good and they're bringing the artwork alive, it brings it right back to you. And this is sort of like this bouncing back of energy where you're like, oh, we're actually okay. And I didn't really think it was going to happen, but because they're doing okay and now I'm doing okay, it's all been great. So they keep me alive. My team has been so awesome. And besides that, I love to take a hike and listen to a podcast on the weekends and sort of have a laugh and, have a drink. So that's amazing.
Thank you.
Hi, sorry. I feel like I'm about to derail the conversation because I want to ask about something you did in the past pre-COVID.
Sure.
But that's okay. And it's about your work on The Kids Are All Right.
Oh, yeah.
I was just curious about how you went about creating that world. And I guess to tie it into the COVID thing, how you would go about creating that world now.
Ages ago, isn't it?
It seems like forever ago.
Yeah. Can't believe people will even remember that movie still.
It's a great movie. What are you talking about?
It was a good movie. It was like, who knew it was going to be Oscar nominated, though, to be honest with you. Right. That's, all of a sudden, I did it in a couple of months. They asked me to do all the prep design work for a brilliant designer, Julie Berghoff, who we're friends now. And we had a nice relationship thereafter for a while I was an art director. Essentially, I was brought in a little sort of parachute style. They needed somebody to come in and help them pre-viz a lot of their build elements. Julie gave me the responsibility of putting together a lot of ideas and design ideas and previs for WYSIWYG, his bar. It was built out of a train station down in Silver Lake, and I built it all out the patio, and didn't get as much camera time as I wanted, but it got enough in the interior. And I got it because I was really fluent in 3D. And they needed it bad. And this was, God, 2006, 2000, maybe even, I don't even know. And so the 3D world was just kind of, it was a little rough and crude. And people were generally still faxing back then, in production and penciling things out. And so I came in and I built everything out in 3D. All of WYSIWYG, all of the houses, built their little homes and could work with Julie on being three-dimensionally inside and then pulling out construction plates. And so I prepared the show and got it all ready for the shoot. When it came time for the shoot, they pared it down because of the budget to just a very, very small staff. And so it was great to see on camera. It was wonderful. And then who knew? It got an Oscar nomination from that. So I was really excited. It was a different experience for me from my general reality world back then. And I brought a lot of appreciation back to reality when I did that movie, because I realized, what we're doing in reality television or variety television, but mostly back then it was like reality, is we're really still telling the story through an environment. Why wouldn't we put some thought process into this? If Julie Berghoff is going to make a fun little house for these characters, we can make the same choices in a reality show. Why not? Like, we could take this medium seriously. So there was like a little bit of a mind shift from that show. So I keep it a little close to my heart, but it was a quick one, and I didn't realize it was going to be such a hit.
Hi, Kai from the Geekery again. You have worked on some really fun, playful shows that are more kind of everyone's in good humor and being good sports than being super competitive. Is there like a design secret that goes into when you're working to try to encourage that kind of just like a positive vibe rather than, you know, getting all cutthroat snipey?
I think the ones that that require like big flashes of character are easy for me because you can probably tell from understanding who I am. I just put that personality straight into it. I really like risk-taking and bold moves. I really like my presence to be felt in a design. And I like sort of, I describe my work as, I work in unscripted, so I'm the script, really. I'm going to create the situation for these people to interact with. And I like playing that role a little bit. It's a little strange, but makes me feel important. So the fun ones, because of maybe my personality, is the ones that are just goofy, you know what I mean? Like the Holy Molies and the Ultimate Tags and that sort of job is really exciting because you can just do whatever you want. You know what I mean? It's big, fabulous character world building, you know? And I love it. And I don't have to read, you know? My dad's an architect and he says there's an equation where, you know, environment plus personality equals a behavior. And I believe it because if I can mix, my environment can mix with whatever actor or talent or contestant is in this space, we're going to get the story out of it. So, you know, I push limits. I just try anything.
You've worked on a huge variety of projects. So I'm just like wondering what tends to draw you to a particular project. And this might be too much of an ask, but is there some sort of almost universal theme or takeaway you want audiences to get from your projects generally?
I take a project, people pitch me projects. It's weird to be in that part of your life. If I feel like it's, you know, if it's cool, if it's exciting, if I would want to be on it or do it, I'll take it for sure. And I'll find a way how to do it. Some projects, you know, I mean, you have to pay payroll, right? So some projects, you know, you have to make yourself want to do it and be on it. And that's also a challenge. And then sometimes the project's just totally impossible. It's out of our world. It's not going to be fit into our schedule. So I look at projects differently. I like different ones though. Most importantly, I don't want to fall into the same creative rut. And so, you know, there comes a point with a cooking project where you're like, I'm taking this because I want to make this different than the other ones I'm doing. And I'm going to challenge myself with this. But I love a unique idea to sort of cross-pollinate the other stuff that I do. So that's exciting too. Like the miniature golf of Holy Moly at first was like, oh my God, you know what? This is completely out of my world. It's miniature golf. How boring. But I took it because it was, I could sort of make it so big and fabulous and sort of, you know, fun, I guess. But also I've learned so much from that production and on how to build a footprint in a world that works. And so I use internally the sort of miniature golf example when I build a world, you know, are we either doing the sort of symmetrical, very tight jewel box? Or are we going to look at this like a miniature golf course where we're sort of spread out with a few different lands? And it's taught me a ton. And it's been like a great thing to look back on and sort of be like, when you hear a project, you're just sort of like, wait, no, I think I can take this because I'm going to learn a lot. So, yeah, they're all different. They should all be different.
Thank you, Swara. Jimmy, you'll be our last question for this. Thank you.
Jimmy, love your background.
Oh, lucky guess. Hey, my name's Jimmy. I'm from Saturday Morning Serial. Thanks for hanging out today, James. Cool. I want to say that Holy Moly is mine and my kids' favorite new show to come out of this 120-day whatever lockdown, whatever's going on. That's really a treat, and we really enjoy it. So I kind of wanted to ask you, what's the pitch session like for that? Do they come to you with ideas? Are you designing all these holes? And also, are there any holes that got shot down and you weren't able to use?
Oh, yeah. There were so many holes that were shot down. And basically, that was between producers thinking through the game and the play and the timing of the play and the difficulty with the contestants of the play and all sorts of different variables go into those challenges and the budgets. And they worked that out a little bit with ABC and myself to navigate a little bit, ballpark. And then together, basically, would come out the game. And then sometimes I themed it out, and sometimes they came up with a theme, like space or something like that. But so it's I would say, Jimmy, it's like a collaboration, really, in terms of... But it generally would start with, like, the producers pitching an obstacle to hit a ball through, and then it would go through a round of quick budgeting, a round of pitching to the network, and then back to a sort of theme to tie it together.
So they would come to you and say, we want a hole, and we want to call it Uranus. And then you would throw a couple pitches at them?
Yep, basically. And, you know, with design, it's you're using the tools that you have on site. And so Uranus came from the Arc de Triomphe, the Paris one from season one.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Thank you. Thanks for
your time. Yeah, for sure.
And again, a very special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Aaron A. And just to fill you in, a co-producer is someone who supports us in a very special way. Everyone who supports us via Patreon, we appreciate immensely. And a co-producer is someone who supports us at the $10 level a month. There are different levels. There are three different levels. And they get a call out for, they get all the benefits that the first, that the lower tiers get, but they also get a call out on as a credit of a co-producer in each episode. We rotate that list. So there is always, since we started it at least, there will always be a co-producer. So thank you again, Aaron A., for so much for your support.
And you know, to our co-producers, I'm pretty sure Ginger will call you whatever you want. Right now, it's just the first name and the last initial. But if you have a special nickname like Huggy Bear or Sweet Cheeks or whatever your nickname is or however you would like to be addressed as a co-producer, I can make that happen for you.
And to find out more how you can support us or how to support us on Patreon, visit patreon.com/OutlanderPod. So thank you guys again so much for listening. We appreciate you guys, all of our listeners, more than you know, and we cannot wait for our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.